I'll call the Environment Policy Oversight Committee to order. We, for March 4th, we do have the minutes from March 2nd to approve. Let's see, do we, Representative Junkie, would you like to move the minutes?
Consider it done.
Representative Junkie moves the minutes for March 2nd. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Today we are starting off with some testimony dealing with the flood issue up in the Red River Valley, and actually we're facing the prospect of flooding in many other parts of the state this year too because of the snowfall that we've received. I know in the Red River Valley, which I represent a portion of, the National Weather Service has said that we're sitting on a keg of dynamite up there. It's a real potentially threatening situation, and preparations are already taking place. They're already filling sandbags up in the valley. And so today we do have with us Mr. John Kerr from the Department of Public Safety. We just want to make sure that that everything's ready to go when the emergency does come, and it looks likely. So I thank you, Mr. Kerr, for joining us today. And one of the things that we're looking for is any guidance of anything that we should be doing to ensure that that all the needs are being met and that we're adequately prepared for what may come. So, again, thank you for coming, Mr. Kerr, and if you could just state your name for the tape and your position before you begin.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Kerr. I'm the Deputy Director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management in the Department of Public Safety, and I have Brad Peters here from our staff. Brad's going to help me with the PowerPoint slides here. But with that, I'm ready to go, Mr. Chairman, if you would like.
Well, thank you. Yes, please proceed. Okay. With
Mr. Chairman, I thought it would be helpful just to have one slide. I want to spend a lot of time on it, but just one slide here that kind of gives the committee an idea in terms of our division's overall role, which is the slide indicates is really to prevent or mitigate disasters, to prepare for them, to respond to them, and to recover from them. And in the emergency management community, for years, we have talked about the four phases of emergency management, which are mitigation, preparedness, response, and recovery. And our mission as an agency is really to coordinate those four functions in the state of Minnesota. We'll move on to the first slide. I have a number of things here now that are specific, Mr. Chairman, members, to your concern, which has to do, of course, with the flooding threat. And I'm going through these in terms of the four phases that I just mentioned. The first one, of course, in the prevention or mitigation area, one of the things that we attempt to do is to provide assistance to local governments so that they can obtain federal mitigation funding. There are a couple of large federal programs, the Hazard Mitigation Grant Program and the Pre-Disaster Mitigation Program, and that's one of our principal tasks is to try to help local governments understand what the requirements are, help them with the application process. We review their applications, submit them into the federal government, and the federal government reviews and approves them and awards the monies, and then we disperse them to the local governments. And I guess I should step back, Mr. Chairman. I didn't mention, and I probably should have, that I am focusing on the four phases here in terms of emergency management, because when we look at flooding threat and our ability to deal with major floods in Minnesota, we have to focus in all four areas because they all contribute to our ability to deal successfully with the flood once it occurs. So that's the first area in the prevention. We'll go on to the next one. Probably one of the best examples of the mitigation projects that we've undertaken in Minnesota in terms of using the federal grant monies has been the purchase and removal of properties that have been repetitively flooded that are in the floodplain, and permanently removing them to higher ground areas outside of the floodplain. And I looked at the number when I was preparing this slide today, and I was recalling I'm being a little nostalgic. Monday is my last day after 31 and a half years with my division. And I remember very, very well that very early, the very beginning of my career, I was our regional program coordinator for Southeast Minnesota, right after the 1978 flooding in Rochester, which some of you may know was pretty devastating. In fact, we lost two lives right there in Rochester. When I look back now and compare the damage we had then when we had flooding compared to the damage we have now, it kind of puts things a little bit in perspective. One of the things that we have done that has really helped significantly in terms of reducing our damage has been the purchase of these structures. The Cedar River, for example, which typically floods up in the spring as well as other areas in the state, almost every year, every other year, we had lots of damaged properties in Austin and other areas along the Cedar. We purchased a lot of homes in that area, and while we still have flooding problems, and Austin always will have some flooding problems, they're nowhere near as severe today as they were then. Same thing along the Red River of the North. I believe the figure is somewhere around 700 properties in East Grand Forks that have been purchased and moved permanently out of the floodplain. So that is an example where we are not only reducing the threat, we have a permanent and total elimination of the threat. And that's why last year, for example, when we had massive flooding along the Red, because of some structural protection that the city has established, but also the removal of lots of properties out of the floodplain, you didn't hear an awful lot last year about flooding in the city of East Grand Forks. So I just wanted to touch a bit on the purchase of these properties as an important mitigation tool. The last bulletin there in the slide gives you some idea of how many federal dollars, these are 100% federal dollars that we've obtained and dispersed to local governments and other eligible applicants. Another item that we're involved with in the prevention area is helping local units of government develop their mitigation plans. And usually when I mention the word plans, people start to yawn because planning is not the most exciting topic in the world, but it's important to understand that local governments are not eligible for any of the federal mitigation dollars unless they have an approved hazard mitigation plan in place. So we do a couple of things. We help them with the planning directly ourselves. We also, in some instances, are able to get federal funding for a contractor to work with those communities. And now those plans really represent that community's blueprint as to how they want to address flooding, not necessarily for the next year, but how they want to address all hazards in their community as they look out over the years. So it's not just a piece of paper, it's a blueprint for their future in reducing the threats to their community. Likewise, we are required at the state level to have an all-hazard mitigation plan that's updated and revised every 3 years, or again, the state's not eligible to receive any federal mitigation dollars. So that's another one of our activities in the prevention area. We'll go on to the next one. In the preparedness phase, probably the first area and one of the most obvious areas for frankly, several months now, our regional program coordinators, we have six regions in the state, six regional program coordinators who work out of their homes and work with the counties. They each have 10, 12, 11 counties that they work with. Those regional program coordinators have been working with the county emergency managers in their region and trying to ensure that the local emergency plans are up to date, that their procedures are adequate. And there's some specific items such as identifying in their plans what is the impact in your community when the water reaches a certain stage. Very important to identify that in order to really ensure that your community is prepared for what happens. Go on to the next one.
And Mr. Kerr, I was just going to ask, how many of these regions are there, these RPCs? How large are they?
Six, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you.
At the state government level, we do chair regular meetings, as the slide indicates, of the Minnesota Emergency Preparedness and Response Committee. That was a committee that we created many years ago, and essentially, as the slide indicates, it consists of representatives of the key agencies in Minnesota state government that typically have a role to play when they have any type of major disaster, like the National Guard, the Department of Natural Resources, MnDOT, the Department of Health, Department of Agriculture, a number of others. And they really are the body that we work with and have tried to communicate, and I think successfully, that emergency management and homeland security at the state government level is not simply the job of our particular division. Every state agency that has a role to play when a disaster occurs has a role to play in terms of emergency management and homeland security. So they are our partners. We go on to the next one. One of our key roles, I think, as an agency is that we are a coordinating agency. I have pointed out to some of our newer employees over the years that we are not dictators. We don't dictate the state agencies nor anyone else. Rather, our job is to make sure that the state, the federal agencies, and the local agencies that need to be involved in preparing for and responding to emergencies and disasters are involved. And so I cited just one example at the bottom of the screen there. We just completed the 6 Spring Flood Coordination Regional WebEx meetings. We have had, since early January, we have had many meetings with the key players, if you will, in flood response in Minnesota: the Corps of Engineers, the DNR, the National Weather Service, the USGS. We've had conversations with FEMA, which is already engaged in some pre-planning in terms of what we intend to do here in Minnesota. So that's a key role for us, is simply getting the players together and making sure that we're all talking and coordinating with one another. Go on to the next one. In the preparedness area as well, both at the federal level and the state level, one area that we've been trying to emphasize is the area of personal preparedness. And we've tried to communicate the message that government, whether it be at the local level, the state level, or the federal level, simply does not have the resources to meet every citizen's needs and every community's needs immediately following a major disaster. We all have to assume some responsibility for ourselves, for our safety of ourselves and our families. And one of those areas of responsibility for those who live in a floodplain, and we have many of them in Minnesota, is to purchase and maintain flood insurance. So we typically try to emphasize that. The DNR, Division of Waters, and my good friend Kent Lockesmo, the division director here, is somewhere, I think, in the room. There he is. The DNR, I think the Department of Commerce, as well as our division, try to emphasize the importance of purchasing flood insurance. We'll move on here. We work very closely with the Corps of Engineers every year, and in fact, the very first flood coordination meeting, if you will, that we have each year is in January, and it's called by the Corps of Engineers and involves the USGS and the DNR and ourselves. Recently, we've requested technical assistance from the Corps, and we are in the process of requesting advanced measures. And not to confuse anybody with I guess government terminology, there are 3 categories of assistance that the Corps of Engineers provides. The first is the technical assistance, and that is just pretty much as it sounds. The second is advanced measures, where the Corps actually goes in and moves dirt. And the last and the most significant is emergency operations. And that's where you would have heard a lot about that last year in Moorhead, where Core had a huge operation going on, of course, in Fargo and in Moorhead. Lots of personnel, lots of heavy equipment, lots of sandbags, and really having a central role in the flood fight. We also have clearly have a role, which we take very seriously, in conducting training and trying to keep people informed of critical information. During the annual Governor's Homeland Security and Emergency Management Conference that's coming up a week and a half, we are, as you can see, going to hold a disaster recovery workshop, particularly for the benefit of those many counties in the state and county emergency managers that are potentially going to be affected by spring flooding. Also, as is true of every governor's Homeland Security Emergency Management Conference, the National Weather Service will have several personnel there who will be providing a very detailed flood forecast for the entire state. One of the areas that's been receiving a lot of attention in recent years has been mutual aid. And we have been actively promoting mutual aid in the state of Minnesota and with other states. Most recently, as noted here, we last year were able to enter into and complete a mutual aid agreement with the state of Wisconsin. Minnesota, like every other state, is a participant in the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, which is the primary state-to-state mutual aid agreement in the U.S. The next one. One item that you may not have heard about that's a little bit on the exotic side, many of you are aware, or some of you may be aware, that the Predator drone is used for monitoring the international border and activities along the international border in the U.S., including the border between Canada and Minnesota. Last year, for the first time, we requested and were granted permission to have Predator overflights of the Red River Valley, which are effective because of the capabilities that the Predator has versus other aircraft. This year we're going to be repeating and expanding the role of the Predator in order to be able to gain ongoing live video feed of water conditions. In the response area, I mentioned our regional program coordinators. They are the folks who, during the flood season, unfortunately for them, live out of their suitcase, working with their counties. They are, you know, on scene, working directly with the county emergency managers and other local officials. The response phase as well, one of the first steps that we take when we have a major event is to activate the Minnesota Emergency Operations Plan. We also are kind of a point of contact in terms of coordinating the and facilitating the provision of lots of different types of resources. One of those happens to be two automated sandbagging machines that we own, that we purchased in part as a follow-up to the 97 flood. And we have one of those that's permanently stationed in a host county and Southwest Minnesota to deal with the Minnesota River, and we have another one that's permanently stationed with a host community up in the Northeast to deal with, the first one is to deal with the Minnesota and the second is to deal with the Red River of the North. One of the agreements, part of the agreement we have with the communities in question is that if there's a higher priority need in another county, that they will work out arrangements with that county and they will release that sandbagging machine to that next county. And we simply move it along as it's needed and as it's requested. Many of you, I think, or most of you are aware that when we have any kind of major emergency or disaster in the state, as a state, coordinate that effort from the State Emergency Operations Center, where we are co-located. We do staff the key positions, but we have, as the slide indicates, we have many other people who also staff the facility. I would say when we have a major event going, whether it be a nuclear power plant exercise or whether it be a major flood such as the one we had last year, we'll probably have 70 to 100 people in the EOC. A lot of those people, majority of them, are going to be state agency representatives, but many people might not be aware that we have other sectors, if you will, represented in EOC, one of them being the voluntary relief agencies. We have a representative of the Red Cross, typically the Salvation Army, some other organizations you may not have heard of, but that have a significant role in rural part of the state, such as the Minnesota Horse Council. And then lastly, and I'll talk about a little bit more about it in just a minute, we have the private sector also represented in the state EOC. One of the things that developed, frankly, thanks to the legislature following the 97 flood, there was a recognition that the state needed to put a little bit more emphasis in trying to corral and coordinate donated goods and volunteers. And we were granted one position, which we retained, and that particular individual focuses on that task. We also have, I mentioned, this public-private partnership, which has really become kind of an exciting development. Throughout last year's flood, for most of that time period, we had, as we call it, the P2CAT representative, a P2CAT representative in the OC. And I guess one of the examples that I can think of in particular, I don't remember the community, but we received a request from a community that indicated that they needed 100 life preservers and they needed them in a hurry. We turned to the P2CAT representative at that time, and that person ended up contacting Target Corporation. And Target had 100 life preservers available, I believe, in something like 24 hours free of charge. So we are, I think, see good things, nothing but good things ahead for developing that public-private partnership. We'll go on. In the recovery area, we have a number of items of guidance, pieces of guidance that we make available to local government that deal with the state and federal disaster recovery assistance programs. Probably the primary document of interest is what we call there the Disaster Management Handbook. We update that every year and distribute copies of it on a CD at the Governor's Homeland Security and Emergency Management Conference in March. Last year, in the exciting months of January and February in Minnesota, we had a traveling road show. Going around the state, we had one disaster response and recovery workshop that we held in each of our regions, just as kind of a short-term preparation for the county officials in terms of what the disaster recovery programs were and what they would need to do to make application, et cetera, et cetera. When we have any major disaster event, emergency event, when we start to hear that this community, that community, this county, or that county has experienced some type of damage, damage that they feel is significant, we ask them to complete what we refer to as the damage and impact assessment form. We provide them with the guidance and copies of the form because we need a standardized a collection, if you will, standardized form with standardized categories of information that we know we're going to need later. So we start off with that process and we collate that information and take a look at it in terms of whether or not it looks like we might possibly have enough damage to warrant some type of federal assistance. If it looks like, in fact, we might have that kind of damage, we contact FEMA and request that they send staff to Minnesota to join with us in the contact in the conduct of a preliminary damage assessment, which is a pretty rapid-fire, two- or three-day, quick and dirty, effort to simply look at the worst disaster sites in the state so that we can get, the federal government can get some idea that the type of damage that local government has been saying it has and that we feel it has, and that has in fact occurred. When we verify through that preliminary damage assessment that yes, indeed, we've had a tremendous amount of damage, we can get a pretty good handle at that point on whether or not we've had a damage, enough damage to qualify potentially for a presidential declaration. We make that recommendation to the governor, and we provide the governor with all the background information that the federal government requires to support a request by him for a presidential disaster declaration. Once we've received a presidential declaration of an emergency or a presidential declaration of a major disaster, our mission is to administer the three primary FEMA disaster recovery and hazard mitigation programs, which I've listed. To give you some idea, because we have had so many presidential declarations in Minnesota over the last 10 years, we currently have 9 open presidential declarations, major disaster declarations. We have 3 open presidential declarations of an emergency that we are, where we are working with all of the applicants, the counties, the townships, the cities, the state agencies, and the eligible private nonprofit entities. And I think we have one last one here. In addition to the FEMA disaster recovery programs, there are always needs in the state that are not met in terms of the FEMA disaster programs. There are other pots of money that are sometimes made available by a special state disaster legislation or other state programs, and we convene those state agencies who have access to those monies into what we call our Recovers Task Force to try to address those unmet needs. And I think, Mr. Chairman, I probably took more time than I should have, but that's the overview.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Kerr. And I think it's unfortunate that you're going to be leaving us on Monday. You have a lot of experience to draw from, and unfortunately, I guess we have a lot of experience with disasters here in Minnesota, which means that we've had some practice at it. But I am concerned about this spring in particular just because of the widespread nature of the threat that we're facing.
Yes.
I don't know if we've ever faced a spring quite like this before. And the Red River Valley, as I already said, as the National Weather Service has said, we're sitting on a keg of dynamite there because of the moisture in the ground, and now with the snowpack on top, and now we hear about flooding potential on the Minnesota River and on the Mississippi River. I guess there is a concern about overwhelming our resources, and I know that the flooding probably takes place in stages, but is that a concern? That do we have the resources necessary to meet emergency situation of this magnitude if we're going to be seeing it happening all across the state? And if you could address that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think over the years I've learned to try not to predict too far in advance how severe or not severe flooding season will turn out to be. Because it really depends on the weather these weeks of March. But as severe as things potentially could be, I bear in mind that we have had floods in Minnesota that have involved 50 to 60 to 70 counties. Certainly if we have a worst case scenario, we're going to have a situation where we perhaps cannot respond everywhere as quickly as we would like. But I think in terms of the coordination, the preparation with the key agencies and the preparation of the local governments involved, I think we're probably in many ways better prepared than we have in just about any other year. We can't control the severity of the flood, but we can control the level of coordination between the agencies and the level of preparedness by the agencies. And I think in that respect, we're probably ahead of where we used to be, you know, 3, 4, 5 years ago even.
Okay, great. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to go to your press releases on buying flood insurance. And could you, do you have any indication if people followed the warnings and have started to purchase? Is it completely voluntary, or do we have any standards where folks that are at very high risk year after year are required to buy flood insurance?
Well, I'll, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'll respond to that in part, and I think my colleague, Mr. Lacismo, may be able to add more information. I would only tell you that in terms of some of the requirements, with the one of the principal FEMA disaster assistance programs is the individual assistance program, which as the title would imply is assistance for private individuals. If a disaster victim that lives in a floodplain is a recipient of an individual assistance grant, he or she is required to maintain their flood insurance. Their grant, if they don't have flood insurance, typically will include money for the purchase of a policy. They are then, in terms of the regulations, they are supposed to maintain that policy. Now, I don't know, frankly, I'm not sure we've had an instance. I don't know from a political standpoint, frankly, if the federal government would really want to get to the point where it would tell an individual victim, I'm sorry, but we can't provide you any assistance because you didn't maintain your policy. I don't think that any of us, and I'll let Mr. Lacismo comment on this too, I don't think that any of us feel that we have the level of flood insurance coverage in Minnesota that we should have, and there are a lot of reasons for that, and frankly, that any state has at this point. And we have, I think, a recent crisis, again, that Mr. Lacismo may be able to comment on, where my understanding is that funding for the continuation of the National Flood Insurance Program was not approved recently by Congress. And I don't know whether that's just a temporary problem or a long-term problem.
I just thought I'd mention, I know that there's been on the news up in our area a lot of encouragement of people to be purchasing flood insurance, certainly based on what happened last year as well, and telling people to do it early enough, because I believe, how long is it, 30 days before
yes.
you'd have to wait before you could collect anything from it.
And it's
a flood event.
It's difficult, particularly in these economic times. The premiums for flood insurance are not cheap, and the basic policy covers the structure. It doesn't include the contents, so if you have a lower level living area, you really need to purchase additional coverage to cover those items. And a lot of people with the economy being as it is, a lot of people, that's one item that, you know, some people decide they can't afford.
Yeah. And I don't know if Mr. Lacismo would want to respond to that issue of flood insurance and what kind of response there has been.
Mr. Chairman, Kent Lacismo from DNR Waters. There, I didn't bring those numbers, but there was a response last year due to the impending flood, and as a fair number of new policies bought. You are correct, there's a 30-day waiting period. There was a little glitch in the system this year because the authorization at the federal level, the flood program, wasn't reauthorized. It has been reauthorized now for the next 30 days, so it's in effect again. But when we looked earlier this spring, in the Fargo-Moorhead area, for example, there's only about 20% of the eligible properties actually carry flood insurance. So it's well below what it should be.
Okay.
And we can provide specific numbers, if you want, on what has changed over time as far as the flood insurance policies. It used to be there was only a 5-day wait, in the effectiveness for flood insurance policy. And then folks, certainly on an area that floods rather slowly, like the Red River Valley, would time that. If they needed it, they'd buy it. Now with the 30-day wait, it's a little bit more risky. And there are examples of people last year that got flooded on day 27 of their waiting period. So they waited a little bit too long. And we certainly wouldn't encourage that, and we would encourage everybody that is in the floodplain, there is a risk. You're 26% more likely to be flooded than to have your house burn if you live in a floodplain during the life of your mortgage. So flood insurance is necessary, but not very many people carry it.
And as far as that 30-day wait, you're saying there's some people who, for instance, on the 27th day they flooded. So it begins with when they're inundated initially, or, I mean, the flood can go for, you know, 40 days.
No, Mr. Chairman, when they buy the policy, it doesn't take effect until 30 days after they have purchased their policy.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're flooded before that 30 days expires, they aren't covered.
Okay. Even if some of the damage is caused after that 30 days, I mean, the water levels continue. So,
yeah.
So, okay. Well, thank you. Mr. Representative Anderson, you have a question.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question out of curiosity. What does a predator plane do that a manned aircraft couldn't?
I don't pretend to be an expert on that, Mr. Chairman, Representative, but I do know that the predator can stay aloft for a very long period of time. There's no issue, of course, of having to worry about pilots and, you know, their restrictions and how much time that they can spend flying and that type of thing. I think they may have some capabilities, too, in terms of live video coverage that's not necessarily readily available otherwise.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Kerr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Locksmo, thank you. We will then move on to the next item on the agenda. We do have Representative Portman here. Welcome, Representative Portman. And I will move your bill, House File 3079, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Portman, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to add a note about the path that the bill, I expect that the bill will travel after it goes to civil justice. I expect that we will be referred to Representative Wagenius's committee. I don't know whether there'll be any fiscal impact, but I do think that it should stop there on its way to the floor. Members, House File 3079 is a bill that seeks to get at the lowest of the low-hanging fruit in an effort to streamline the environmental permitting and review process. In Minnesota, we have both a perception problem and a reality problem with regard to environmental review and permitting. The perception problem in the small business community is that it takes forever to get a permit and to go through environmental review, and that it's very uncertain of the outcome, and that you may have a lot of duplication and you may have to do the same thing for multiple different governmental agencies, and that there's no right answer. The reality problem is that sometimes it does take too long for projects to get approval, and we can certainly do better. I think the perception problem is a bigger problem than the reality problem. We need for our business community to have faith in the environmental regulations that we have, and for them to know that the system is working well. We also need for people outside of the state to know that Minnesota is open for business and that we are interested in having businesses come and locate in our state. At the same time, in Minnesota, we value our clean water and our clean air, and we are not interested in tearing any holes in the safety net that protect the environment. What a lot of people don't know about environmental review is that the vast majority of it is completed at the city and the county level. And the city and the county are bound by 60-day timelines, and that very little environmental review in the big scheme of things, happens at state agencies. So it's not necessarily a state agency problem or issue. It's a review process that touches many areas of government. The other thing that the bill tries to do is build on the success that the agency has already accomplished. The Pollution Control Agency and the DNR have really sped up the time that it takes to complete environmental review over the last 5 years. They've been driving the time that it takes. I just wanted to give you just a brief idea of how many people or how many governmental entities do environmental review. In the last two fiscal years, there's been 55 cities that have done environmental review, over 50 counties. The MPCA has done 45 environmental reviews, MnDOT 15, DNR 13. So you can tell from those numbers that more than half are city and county projects. The shortest review process in environmental review in Minnesota has been 44 days. We believe that was completed by the MPCA. And the longest was 1,825 days, and that's MnDOT. And MnDOT kind of belongs in a special category, and I really think that their numbers should be thrown out when we're computing the averages, because they are both the proposer and the reviewing entity, and we're talking about major interstate projects like the Stillwater Bridge that kind of throw the numbers up. And a small business isn't going to have to deal with those kind of delays when they're getting permits or undergoing environmental review. So when going through House File 3079, the first three sections are about declaring a permitting goal timeline. It sets in statute that the goal of the state would be to complete environmental permits within 150 days at the state agencies. So Section 1 pertains to the Department of Agriculture. Section 2 pertains, I believe, to the DNR. And Section 3 to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. It sets a goal. It's not a binding goal, but what we're looking for is more information on when something takes longer than 150 days. Why does it take longer than 150 days? Is it because we have a proposer who is not responsive? Is it because we have scientific or technical disagreements? Does the agency have a lack of staff? Or is there an intense interest on behalf of the public that necessitates delay in the review? And with that better information, we can do a better job of making sure these happen as fast as they can, but not too fast to protect the environment. Section 4 of the bill would change the location for an appeal of a decision on the need for an environmental assessment worksheet, the need for an environmental impact statement, or the adequacy of an environmental impact statement. Right now, if there's a dispute on those three items, the dispute goes to district court. If there's a dispute with regard to a permit, it goes right to the Court of Appeals. What Section 4 does is it makes the environmental review and the environmental impact statement dispute go right to the Court of Appeals as well. The idea there is to reduce the timeline for the conflict, to make the process parallel between the permit and the environmental review, and to save expenses. There's an extensive factual record that's developed when people are doing an EAW and an EIS. And what a district court typically does is develop a factual record. So since the review process that happens is basically a review of a decision that's been made on a factual record that's typically complete, it makes sense to go to the Court of Appeals to save time. Now, in the last 48 hours, I've become aware that there may be some issues with going right to the Court of Appeals in this kind of a case. And the Land Stewardship Project and I have met today, and we're working on this section. I don't know how in-depth this committee wants to get with regard to that section, because this is the reason we're going to civil justice, and I imagine that'll be the primary focus of the hearing in civil justice. Section 5, the last section of the bill, provides for customized environmental assessment worksheet forms. Right now, I believe the EAW has approximately, it's between 26 and 30 questions, and there's one customized form, and that's for feedlots. But there are other projects that are frequently submitted, ethanol plants, wastewater treatment plants, and so it makes sense for there to be an environmental assessment worksheet that's geared towards that type of a project. And what I neglected to mention about Sections 1, 2, and 3 is that they also ask the state agencies, or they require the state agencies, to allow electronic submission of environmental review and permit documents, and that's an effort to streamline the process. If it would be okay, at this time I'd like to discuss my amendment, and hopefully everybody has it. It should be labeled A10-2241.
Yes, we do have that in your packets, the A10-2241. And I will move that amendment to get it in the order and shape that the author would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So, and Representative Hortman, if you'd like to speak to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment adds a section which the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy and the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce worked together to get language, because what we're trying to do is ensure that there's no duplication for project proposers at different stages of environmental review and permitting, so that they're not doing the same thing twice. Mm-hmm. And so the language in the amendment that's relevant, there's a lot of words in the amendment, but the only real change is on page 3, lines 14 through 16, which just make clear that we're not going to be duplicating efforts at different stages of the process. There's one other issue we're still, well, there's two other issues we're still working on. One, I feel confident we will be able to get language we agree on. Another that is kind of up in the air right now. And the area that we're still working on the language is that when Minnesota has a standard that's stricter than the federal standard, it should be clear to everybody why it is we have a stricter standard. And right now in rules, it's required that we state why we're stricter than the feds. But there is a reason to put it in statute, because this is about communicating with the public, with our business community, about why we're doing what we're doing. We're not just harder because we like more process. We sometimes have higher standards because we have better air and better water, and it's more important to us than in some other states. So we don't have an amendment on that yet, but hopefully by the time we get to Representative Wagenius's committee, we'll have an agreement on language there.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions at all for the author? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hortman, thanks for bringing it forward. Can you explain the other one? You began, you said there's two of them, we're close on one, and then you stopped.
Right.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McNamara. The other piece that we have talked about is giving project proposers the permission to hire a consultant to do a draft EIS that would then be submitted to the responsible governmental unit, and the responsible governmental unit would be permitted to basically throw it out and say it's no good and start over, or review it or amend it, and the project proposer still would bear all the costs of the review of the EIS. The question is just, when you allow the project proposer to hire the consultant and go ahead and prepare a draft EIS, does that create a situation where you're putting the fox in charge of the hen house? Would there be too close of a relationship between the project proposer and the engineers, so that the engineers wouldn't be fleshing out all the issues that need to be fleshed out in an EIS? And what we've been talking about is a way to ensure that the ethics of the professionals who are hired to do EISs, for example, your bar engineering type organizations, whether there's a way to have safeguards that make clear they're not going to be responding to the project proposer, but they are going to be responsibly listing all the issues that an EIS should, and that they're going to be responsibly evaluating all the things that an EIS should.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I wasn't quite following you, but now I do, because I think I'm familiar. Don't we, if you're involved in maybe a cleanup, I'm trying to think, we have the tank cleanup where you have the we pay in a fee on our gas tax, so that if you're in a Representative Dill, would you repeat that again, Representative Dill?
Petrol fund.
Thank you. I didn't quite hear him there, but in that case, don't we allow the contractor? I think they do just what you're talking about. So don't we have an example of where we're currently doing that, and isn't it working in that case? You allow them, you hire the the person hires the engineering firm to do that work. Don't we have an example of that currently going on?
Representative Horstmann.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I'm not at all familiar with the Petro Fund and how that works and if it's working well or poorly.
Okay.
Representative
Mr. Chair, I would just recommend, Representative Horstmann, that as you move it forward, you talk with, both MPCA, I believe, and Commerce are all involved in that, but I think that's a case of where folks are hiring the consultant to work for them in that process, and I'm not aware of that not working. As a matter of fact, there's, you know, you have to have a good system there, and those engineering firms or whatever have to have integrity and honesty, or they're not going to get any business. So I would recommend that.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative, the 150-day guideline, I think, is admirable. Are there any real consequences if an agency doesn't make a ruling on a permit in that timeline other than to issue a report?
Representative Horstmann.
Chair Egan and Representative Anderson, no, there's no consequences. This isn't a you shall do it or else. This is just saying that this is our goal and we're hoping to get there. And I think with a lot of things in life, when you set a goal and you constantly evaluate whether you're measuring the goal, you're much more likely to meet it. And I think if we were to look at putting a deadline in statute, we wouldn't be able to move a bill forward and start to have an effect on this process. I think a goal is the right way to start.
And Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Horstmann, and you talked a little bit about the jurisdiction where the bill goes and that there are sections here on civil justice and there's going to be finances. I want to circle back to the environmental policy. And do you believe there's anything in this bill that's going to weaken environmental protection or strengthen environmental protection? Or is there really no effect in term other than just speed? What is the impact on Minnesota's environment with this bill?
Representative Horstmann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, I don't think there's anything in this bill that would weaken protection. I would not be carrying a bill that I thought would threaten Minnesota's air or water quality. And the reason I'm carrying it, and I think everybody here knows how much I care about the environment, and is because I think it actually does strengthen protection. Because as long as we have a business community that has been told for 8 years that we have a regulatory and environment in Minnesota that's not conducive to opening businesses here and keeping businesses here, we're going to have a lot of suspicion about the environmental laws we have in place and then a desire to weaken them and to definitely not add new things, you know, like maybe clean car standards or things like that. People don't want more regulation if they perceive the existing regulation to be a problem and to be not functioning well. So I think by increasing the speed of the process, we'll increase faith in the system, and I think that's good.
Any other questions? Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had to see if I heard something correctly. Representative Hillstrom, are you saying that for the last 8 years, you're believing what the administration has put forward as a message, and you believe our business community has bought into that in its entirety?
Representative Horstmann.
Chair Egan, Representative Falk, you've asked two questions. One was whether I believed it, and the second was whether I thought the business community believed it. I think when you have the chief executive of the state saying something about the business climate, people are inclined to believe it. And, you know, whether he has a point, you know, I started out by saying I think there's a perception problem, and I think there is a reality problem. I'm sure even the agencies would probably be able to point to cases that they thought they could have moved, they would have liked to have moved faster on a permit or an environmental review if they had been able to have more communication with the project proposer earlier in the process or more communication with the public. So I'm not saying that there's not a real problem, but I do think the perception problem is a big one, and I do think that our chief executive of the state has had a little bit to do with that.
Representative Falk.
Thank you. So Representative Horstmann, but you have no data to say whether or not that we've seen this many businesses that have not come into the state or to have come in and this has not proven to be a problem or perception. I'm seeing if there's some way to quantify this. That, I mean, we can say that this may be an issue or it may not be an issue, but there should be some way to quantify it too if we're going to consider putting this on our law book or our books.
Representative Horstmann.
Chair Egan, Representative Falk, I think the report that was put out by the MPCA in response to legislative direction in the last session, the Environmental Review Streamlining Report, does have metrics in it, and it talks about how long the process takes. And right now, I would say if you tell the average Minnesotan that the median time frame for environmental review in Minnesota is 228 days, unfortunately, MnDOT's thrown into that mix, and so that throws things off. They would say that sounds like it takes way too long. And when I want to start a business, I might want to take advantage of a certain growing season or a certain retail season, and injecting a 228-day delay is not something that's probably good for businesses who are thinking about opening in the state. So there are metrics on it, and there's some intangibles, you know, that we can't measure. But I think if we say in statute we have a goal of doing these things quickly and doing them well, that communicates to the business community, and I think it would have an intangible positive effect.
And Representative Sterner.
Thank you, Chair Egan. Just from my experiences before I got here, worked with the city of Rosemont, and we worked with permitting with SKB, which is a landfill, and Flint Hills Resources. Some of the timetables fairly long and cumbersome, and I think also with my small business experience getting here, that was one of the cited things was the regulation, the time for permitting was an important thing to bring forward. So I think that's why we're trying to get this accomplished to that. So I guess I've seen it being a problem in the past.
Okay. And let's see, I guess next is Representative Bigham.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and Representative Portman. Not really a question, just more of a comment, is that I think this is a good idea, and I think it's important that we look at, as also a local former local elected official, I think it's important that we look at not duplicating and making the processes more cumbersome. So I thank you for bringing this forward.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hortman, Representative Falk kind of sparked my interest when he talked about how things were here. And you mentioned the timeline of 200 and some days or 100 and some days to get a permit. How would that compare to, say, like Iowa? If you were thinking about building a industrial plant in, say, Swift County or deciding between northwestern Iowa, how is the permitting in Iowa compared to Minnesota?
Representative Hortman.
Chair Egan, Representative McNamara, the number that I cited is the timeline for environmental review. It's the median for environmental review. Permitting typically happens shorter. I don't happen to have those numbers, but I know that the agencies have those numbers, and that takes a shorter period of time. I can't say, though, how long it takes in Iowa, though I will say that the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act really dictate the air and the water permits. And the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act are the same all over the country.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just strongly recommend to all the members on the committee that they take a look and see. We do have the same federal government requirements, but you should look at Iowa and realize that today people aren't going to come to Minnesota to do it with the regulations we're putting on them. They're not going to come here, and whether it's a biomass ethanol plant or what it might be in the future, you should talk to some of the folks that have been through this process and what they've been through and cost and delays and not knowing, and then they compare it when they built a plant, say, in Iowa, and what's happened there. I just think, Representative Hortman, thank you for bringing this forward. This is long overdue, and the only thing is it doesn't go far enough.
And let's see, anyone else have questions? Representative Lewin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and hopefully a quick question for Representative Portman. You mentioned sort of the average time frame and hoping to reduce that down. Do you also have information that report on how many of the permits are actually granted at the end of that time period? Maybe a percentage or?
Representative Portman.
Chair Eakin, Representative Loon, the report on environmental review streamlining just covers the topic of environmental review and not environmental permits, but I do believe that the MPCA and the DNR have information about what percentage of permits are issued. My recollection is it's fairly high.
Okay. Representative Loon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think that maybe would be an important piece of information, because as we're looking at this, and I think some of the comments to echo the concerns raises that if most of them are actually being permitted, so the information is there, you know, they are following our guidelines and they are abiding by the high standards we want to have for our environment. It's just if it's taking too long to get there, that's a problem. And so I want to applaud you for taking this step, and I would concur with Representative McNamara's point, which is it's a first step, but we need to keep looking at this.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, we do have three testifiers who would like to come forward. First, Mr. Tony Quillis from the Minnesota Chamber.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I, along with Mike Robertson, represent the chamber here at the Capitol. I will be brief. I understand that you've got another DNR bill behind you and a resolution from Representative Dill also on the agenda. The chamber, through a number of venues, through regional meetings that we have, a survey that we do of our members, a survey that we do of the general business community, and then an affiliate of the chamber called Grow Minnesota. Some of you know Bill Blazer. Used to do some lobbying for us down here, has left to go over and head up Grow Minnesota, where we visit businesses throughout the state, thank them for doing business here in the state, and ask them if there's anything that we can do to help them with their business here in Minnesota. In all those venues, environmental permitting and review has come up. So with that, last year we were, Representative Wagenius's bill had a provision in it that Representative Hansen put in that started the environmental streamlining review that the PCA did. And then with that, Mr. Chairman, we took pen to paper, and Representative Hortman has worked very hard with a number of interested groups to put together what you have before you today, and that we're supportive of.
Okay. And Representative Wagenius.
Mr. Chair, one of the issues that we have in timelines, in particularly in EAWs, is that proposers don't pay for them. The general taxpayer pays for them. In this budget climate, there's no question that the Pollution Control Agency's budget is going to be reduced substantially. The DNR's budget is going to be reduced substantially, which will go counter to what Representative Portman is trying to do. Under those circumstances, is the chamber willing to say that folks asking for environmental review, EAWs, pay for those, the cost of those?
Mr. Chairman, Carlos. Representative Wagenius, I don't think that anything in House File 3079 is going to put the agencies involved, the Pollution Control Agency, the DNR, and the Department of Agriculture, at any undue financial burdens. Now, in regards to environmental assessment worksheets, that's a conversation that we can have as we move forward in your committee and in your budget. I think it's going to be Monday and Wednesday. But as far as what we have in this proposal before you today, I do not believe that there is any undue financial burdens put on any of those state agencies.
Okay. Representative Wagenius.
Well, the reality check is that because of the state budget and the shortfall, while we don't have our targets yet, there's no question that there's going to be substantial reductions in the Pollution Control Agency and in DNR. It will happen. It's going to be substantial. Given that, it runs counter. I mean, you have to have money to pay to get these things done. The cuts in the budget are going to slow things down. So my question is, and maybe you wait and answer the question when you get to finance, in air permits, their review, the proposers pay the full cost of the permits and the reviews. But in water, that's not, they're subsidized. They're subsidized by the general taxpayer. So the question will be when we get to finance, are those folks who are asking for speedy permits willing to pay rather than ask the general taxpayer to pay?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, not to give Mr. Robertson nightmares again, but this goes back to the Blue Ribbon Commission in 19, I'm not going to be able to come up with the date, but this is a conversation that we've been having, as you know, for over 20, 30 years on how we can better put this along. And that is a conversation that I think we should have, and probably is more, not to take the committee's time, probably more fruitful in your division.
Representative Junkie.
To that point, and certainly Representative Dill and others are aware of this, to Representative Wagenius, the answer in many cases is yes. Businesses are willing to pay if they can be guaranteed the work is done and if they can choose their own firm or person to do the work and not have to depend on someone that DNR hires and then rehire someone else and then rehire someone else when the job isn't getting done. The answer is yes. If they could guarantee fast turnaround and hire the firm that is qualified to do this themselves, they will pay for it.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Quillis, could you please detail specifically what industries you think would be most benefited by this bill or these changes? And just, I mean, I want to get my head around what we're looking at. Who is having the trouble? Who's having the difficulty? Who in your organization is really asking for this? And have they had significant issues?
Mr. Quillis.
Representative Falk, off the top of my head, the individuals that are probably going to benefit from some of the examples I can think of right off the top of my head are the League of Minnesota Cities. They are folks that do a number of wastewater treatment plants, and they're the proposers as well as being the RGU. And in terms of a customized worksheet that we talked about, Representative Portman referenced that we do it for feedlots right now. We've done enough wastewater treatment plants in this state that we could do a customized environmental assessment worksheet for wastewater treatment plants. And I think that would benefit businesses that have those, but also would benefit cities. In terms of other businesses that would benefit, I mean, there are anybody that applies for a permit in this state or has to undergo environmental review is going to be able to benefit from this bill.
Okay. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Quillis, I think if the cities wanted to speak to the permitting process, they would be here. But I'm looking for industries. I mean, is it particular? I mean, is it refineries? Is it in agriculture? Is it in some type of manufacturing? There's got to be some examples that we could look to and say that this is the reason why we're bringing this forward. I mean, I'm just looking for some example.
Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Falk, a woodworking plant, anybody that deals with woodworking, a dry cleaner, a refinery, an auto body shop, an auto recycler, wood industry, you know, paper industry, taconite industry, anybody that has to apply for a permit in the state, anybody along agricultural pursuits that has to apply for a permit or submit an EAW or an EIS is going to benefit from the time frames that are set up.
Mr. Chair, I did want to add
Representative Hartman.
Thank you. In partial response to Representative Falk's question, we did have the League of Cities working with us, the entities that worked the hardest on the language and spent a lot of hours were the League of Minnesota Cities, the Chamber of Commerce, and the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. So we definitely, because they're a big actor as both a proposer and a reviewer, included them in the conversation.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And if we're looking for examples, Representative Falk, I can give you one that you would appreciate. It involves an ethanol plant, which is one in your district. This one We met a couple of weeks ago, and they told us that they've been working since 2005 to get their permits, hadn't heard a reply from MPCA for 18 months, and still don't have their permits some 5 years later. And we were told that if they had known all of the problems they were going to be facing, they would never have built in Minnesota. And that's a sad commentary of our system, if that's an indication. So, yeah, I think that's an example of why we need something like this.
Yeah. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also have to give an example to Representative Falk of a very small city. You know, one of the cities I represent went through years, literally years, of trying to get through a permitting process with the PCA that should have gone much, much faster for a very small project. And if we would have had some streamlining, it would have saved everybody a lot of money. It was a situation that it just dragged on and on. I can go into detail later if you want. But I know of one example of a small city that would have benefited from some streamlining.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Mr. Quillis. And next we have two testifiers coming forward, Mr. Paul Sibizinski and Ms. Karna Peters. Welcome, Mr. Sibizinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here today on behalf of the Land Stewardship Project. I am Paul Sibizinski. I'm a farmer. I also work on the policy program for the Land Stewardship Project. Land Stewardship Project is a farm and rural organization that works to support sustainable agriculture. We work for a policy that supports family farms, the community, and the environment. As a farmer myself, I've been involved in the issues in the environment going back to the 1990s before I went to work for the Land Stewardship Project. In our community in Redwood County, we were faced with three large hog facilities that were proposed with large livestock lagoons for hogs. The community joined together and said no to that kind of development. Meanwhile, in another county, not too far from us, Renville County, by a vote of the county commissioners, implemented those kinds of facilities, and a number of problems resulted with that. Eventually, through the process, the state of Minnesota finally put a ban on lagoons as it relates to hogs. And I bring this up because I think it's important for us all to realize, no matter how we're looking at a bill, that it's important that the public has the opportunity to be involved in protection of the environment, that they have a meaningful role to play in that regards. The Land Stewardship Project, as I said, is involved in livestock agriculture. We support it. We were part of a Citizens Task Force report that came out in 2004 that encouraged livestock development in a way that enhanced family farms, the community, and the environment. We did that task force in connection with not only our organization, but the Sustainable Farming Association of Minnesota, the National Farmers Organization, and the Minnesota Farmers Union. And one of the recommendations that we had as a task force was, for example, strengthening the environmental review. And we strongly believe in that. In regards to my testimony regarding this bill to today, there's two aspects that I'd like to convey regarding the bill. The 150-day goal period that's in the bill in terms of a goal to turn around a permit, we should be clear that it does not shortchange the environmental review process. That includes both the EAW process, and after the EAW process, there could be a potential EIS process. So we had that conversation with Representative Hartman about that. We think it's important that that part does not shortchange that process, that there's adequate time, you know, for the public to be involved. With that, the other concern we have is the piece about district court, and I believe that Karna Peters, who's here, probably could represent that better than I can. So,
thank you. Ms. Peters, would you like to?
Thank you.
You could state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Chair Eakin, and members of the committee. My name is Karna Peters, and I'm a member of the law firm Peters & Peters, and I live in Glenwood, Minnesota, just down the road from Representative Anderson. The nature of our practice has taken us to all different parts of the state. We have represented groups of Minnesotans on several different environmental review cases. We've represented them in district courts as well as in the Court of Appeals. And I've been involved in environmental review cases for quite a while, and was also involved in a review of the environmental review rules that took place somewhere in the 2002 time period under the Ventura administration, when a group of us got together. We're asked to get together to look at ways that we might change environmental review, and this topic of possibly having environmental review done with appeals to the Court of Appeals and not to the district court came up at the time, and I and other lawyers had raised concerns about that, and that's why I was asked to come to speak today about some of those concerns. And what happens is that most county and city and township ordinances provide that appeals of permit decisions or zoning decisions would go to the district court. And so typically what might happen is that if you have an environmental review challenge, that would take place, it has taken place in district court. And then there's also a permit or a zoning decision appeal, and both of them typically are consolidated in district court. So this kind of provision that would require going to the Court of Appeals could create issues, because then you might have part of the case in Court of Appeals and the other part in the district court. And I think that it creates other issues in particular regarding things like injunctions or bonds. If you look at the subdivision 10 here, it refers to the possibility of a bond or the possibility of a temporary restraining order and injunction. And those are things that typically would take place at a district court. Although the Court of Appeals does have the ability to do that kind of thing, they typically don't get involved in that, and I don't think they would have the desire to do that. It also raises some concerns about access to justice, because these kinds of cases, they've been brought in the district court where the project is located typically, and that gives people who are concerned about the project, who are involved in an appeal, the opportunity to go to the district court and hear the arguments on both sides. The Court of Appeals would meet in St. Paul or possibly in a satellite courtroom, but that means people have to travel a long ways to go there. And typically those courtrooms are small, so they don't have the same size of a district court, wouldn't have as much room for people to attend a hearing. I hope that this doesn't reflect any distrust of the district court judges, because in our experience, the district court judges in Minnesota are very good. They're thorough. They really pay attention to the issues. They know that that these cases involve very significant concerns for people in the local community, concerns about impacts on possibly water availability, concerns about air impacts, concerns about sensitive areas of lakes. And they really, in our experience, they really do take time to try to understand it and reach a good decision in the cases. There are also issues about briefing and filing difficulties. The Court of Appeals requires special briefs. You have a 30-day time period for appeal of environmental decision, and so that creates issues if you have to file a special briefs in the Court of Appeals. You have much more flexibility with the district courts. It's easier to get hearings and to do briefing schedules in the district court level than you would at the Court of Appeals. I also had a comment on the permitting efficiency part. Paul mentioned the concerns about environmental review. I don't think it was the intention. I think the goal is good to try to do permits quickly. I just think that it could be read potentially as to put pressure on agencies to shortcut environmental review because they have to get a permit issued, and I don't think that's the intention, but it might be worded so that you would avoid that kind of situation. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Peters. Any questions? Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Peters, could you explain or detail kind of the people who are bringing these challenges, just to kind of versus the if a challenge is brought, you describe the people that are bringing the challenge versus the person who is being challenged or the entity.
Well, the people
Ms. Peters.
Thank you, Chair. the people that we represent, it could be a wide variety of people. We represented farmers. We represented engineers, doctors, lawyers, scientists who live in a local area. We've represented lake associations. We've represented groups like Trout Unlimited. And what we found, it's very interesting, what we found in all different parts of Minnesota where these cases are brought. These are people in the local community who really know their local area and might know about the special sensitivities of their area, you know, especially in cases on water availability. They may know that a project might create issues on water availability that might affect their drinking water supplies. So they're very concerned and they get involved in these cases. Is that the kind of response that you were looking for there?
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Peters, it does help clarify for me, but I look at this as if a group is looking to bring forward an appeal, I'm assuming that they have typically a far shorter amount of time to put together that appeal, to go and retain an attorney, to go and do the necessary steps if they do have legitimate concerns about a project that's being pushed forward, versus the proposers, in my assumption, had a fairly long period of time to put together their documents, to go and work with their attorneys, to work with their counsel. And just, I want to understand if this change is in some way tilting the legal playing field in favor of the proponent against maybe what the wishes would be of local people. And that is concerning to me if that would be the case.
Ms. Peters.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Representative Falk. I think that that one of the largest concerns that the people that we represent might have is that I think you raise a good concern about the timing. It is difficult for people to really understand the impacts of a decision and how to appeal that in a short period of time. You have 30 days to appeal, and that is difficult for Minnesotans who may not be experienced in the legal system. And I think they would also be concerned about the ability to get to have their case heard locally in the district court in their area, so that they could actually feel like they can participate in that process.
Okay. Any other Representative Falk?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do believe Ms. Karnas or Ms. Peters raises some excellent points there, and I do have major concerns with this section, and I don't know if Representative Hortman would be willing to help address them.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Falk, like I said at the outset, this is an issue we'll get into in civil justice. It's the only issue we'll get into in civil justice. And I will be working with the Land Stewardship Project and others who are concerned about this in between now and when we're heard in civil justice. But I would also say the reason why it's in here is not to tilt the playing field towards the proposer. I, and I'm sure many others in here, are donors to organizations who take actions on behalf of the environment. And as you probably well know, litigation is very expensive. And if we are shortening the timeline, we're saving money for both the people who challenge the decision and for the people, the proposers, maybe the people who are not the proposers and the proposers, I guess, would be the way to say it, because either one of those parties could end up challenging the decision. So to me, it was a way of increasing the speed and saving money, whether a person was an environmentalist or a corporation, that we focus on getting to a decision faster and a good decision, and that we're not just slowing down projects that maybe in the end will be permitted to go forward. Or that if we're going to stop a project, we do it sooner in the timeline than later.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hortman, I appreciate that in your comments. I still do have concerns, and with that, I would move to delete Section 4 of the bill.
Okay. And Representative Falk makes a motion to amend the bill to delete the change in Section 4. Sure. So, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, I'd urge members to vote against this motion. I have concerns just the opposite way. The people that try to blockade these projects, one of their main schemes is to delay and delay and delay and cause more time and more expense, and just by in itself getting in the way of a project that could be worthy. And these things don't come out of the blue, these projects. They give out a lot of notice, and they know a lot of long time ahead of time when they should get their paperwork done. And that's plenty amount of time to get to court. And so I have concerns just the opposite way.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Loon.
Mr. Chairman, I ask for a roll call on this.
Okay, roll call has been requested. Okay, Representative Faulk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would respond as well that I do feel it's important that these projects, if they are happening in a local community, the community should have the ability to have their voice heard in as local of a setting as possible. I do think it's more difficult to ask people to come down to St. Paul to a Court of Appeals hearing than it would be to go to their local community. And we want to make sure that the local people's voices are heard. And I think this is an issue of local control, that you keep the where the decisions are being made as close as possible to the local level. And so I do have concerns. I understand my colleague, Representative Cornish's concerns, but I feel that it's important to keep these decisions at least in an initial at the local district court.
And Representative Hortman, did you want to respond?
No, I think we've had a thorough discussion. I would imagine members are prepared to vote.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for council or staff here on jurisdiction. That the debate on this has been related to civil justice rather than environmental policy, and I'm just a little confused on that.
Yeah. And that is correct. It is dealing with civil justice, although amendments can be offered for areas related to any portion of the bill during the committee. So, and I don't know if council has anything to add to that. Okay. So, Representative Bigham.
Let's just point out to Representative Hortman, you wouldn't have to go to civil justice then.
I don't think that's the case. But,
okay.
So any other comments or questions? Okay, seeing none, roll has been requested, so clerk will take the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Clarification, we're voting on Representative Falk's amendment, correct? Mm-hmm.
That is correct, Representative Anderson, to delete the changes in Section 4.
Negative.
Representative Bigham.
No.
Representative Cornish?
No.
Representative Dill?
No.
Representative Druskowski? Representative Eakin?
No.
Representative Faulk?
Yes.
Representative Gardner?
No.
Representative Hackbarth?
No.
Representative Hansen?
No.
Representative Junkie?
No.
Representative Loon?
No.
Representative McNamara?
No.
Representative Purcell? Representative Saylor?
No.
Representative Sterner?
No.
Representative Thiessen? Representative Wagenius?
Yes.
Okay, there being 2 ayes and 13 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. So, any other comments or questions for the testifiers? Okay, seeing none, thank you for coming forward. And Representative Hortman, did you have any final statements at all?
No, Mr. Chair, I'm sure the members are ready to vote.
Okay, then I will renew the motion that House File 3079, as amended, be recommended to pass to the Committee on Civil Justice. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails, and the bill is passed.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Next on the agenda is House File 3092, Representative Eakin. Representative Eakin, no offense to the Department of Public Safety, but while they were doing their presentation, I was going through all your author's amendments and whatnot. So you've got three author's amendments on various topics you'd like to add those on so we can put this in the shape that you'd like.
That is correct. And first, I would like to move House
I'm sorry, Representative Eakin, if you could move your bill first, and then we'll
sure. I'd like to move House File 3094 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Civil Justice.
Very good. Representative Eakin moves the bill that I recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Eakin, do you want to start with the A1 amendment?
Yes, I would like to move the A1 amendment, get it in the shape and form that I would like.
Very good. Representative Eakin moves the 3094 A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Motion passes. Amendment is adopted. Let's see. You've got the A2 amendment, Representative Eakin?
Yes, I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Representative Eakin moves the 3094 A2 amendment. And you can explain all these, I guess, when we get it all together. But all those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
One to nothing.
Those opposed? Are you serious? Okay. Don't fool around. I'm sorry, everybody's been shuffling a paper, and I'm going a little bit too fast. Good. Everybody in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Thank you. Motion passes. Amendment's adopted. Now we have the A3 amendment.
Yes, I'd like to move the A3 amendment.
Author moves the 3094 A3 amendment. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if the author could just quick explain. I see it's raising the limits. Is this along with that deal where they're just a few pounds over or something?
Representative Eakin.
Actually, Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, this addresses the newer ATVs that are electric ATVs that are heavier because of the batteries. So that's the reason that this change is being made. I guess it's a green amendment because obviously the electric ATVs don't emit as many gases. So.
Okay. All those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion passes. Amendment is adopted. Very good. Representative, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the DNR technical bill, and there are many aspects to it that Mr. Meyer is here to explain, and I would like to turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Meyer.
Very good. Welcome, Assistant Commissioner Meyer. Welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name and all that for the record, please. Great.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. As Representative Eakin has stated, this is the department's technical bill. There's many different provisions in here. I'm going to do my best to walk through them. I do have other staff in the audience that can help us answer technical questions if they do arise. With that, you should have a fact sheet, I believe, in your packet. If you want to follow along with that, I'll be working off of the bill and that. So, starting with Section 1, Sections 1, 3, and 4 deal with our ability to service billings to other entities. We work with a lot of different organizations to provide efficient use of our fleet, facilities, or other professional services. These three sections provide us the ability to capture the cost of those services, clarify that we can charge for those services. The first one would be to provide professional services or support, such as if working with the Red River Basin or something like that, if we're providing clerical support, we'd be able to capture our revenues back for that or bill back for those activities.
So, Mr. Meyer, you can't do that now, or you just need explicit legislative authority to do it?
Mr. Chair, members, we just want to clarify that we can do that right okay. now. That we can. You'll see the language that we have in these three sections allows us to bill to other governmental units, including tribal governments. So we're just clarifying that we have that authority. Section 2, last session, we had a bill that was actually passed by Representative Hansen in this body to authorize us to sell gift cards. We want to be able to utilize our new ELS system coming online to be able to do this and also issue not only duplicate safety training cards, but your initial safety training cards as we move forward with the evolution of this new system. You'll see those changes on 2.6 and 2.7. Section 3 on page 3, beginning on 3.7, our fleet management account. This is where the revenues from fleet services go for our cars, our heavy-duty equipment. It clarifies again that we can charge other governmental units, including tribal governments, for the use of these equipment. And Section 4 is relates to the facilities side of this, facilities management account that we're able to charge to those authorities the cost of providing them with building or infrastructure facilities if we do need to do that. Section 5, 6, 7, and 8 relate to its permissive language that relates to collector snowmobiles and collector ATVs. Currently, if you have a snowmobile or an ATV that's 25 years old or older, you do not need to register it. However, for a snowmobile, you can only use it at 10 events per year. And for an ATV, you can use it wherever, but there's no registration on that. So it came about from ATV users actually being pulled over because they had no registration on their machines from our conservation officers. They said, can't you give us a registration for this? This is voluntary. It's $6. So Section 6 establishes the one-time registration fee for snowmobiles on 4.8. That's Section 5 there, beginning on 4.8. Section 6 has that exemption collector unlimited snowmobile use. So if you have a collector snowmobile and you want to ride it more than 10 times a year, you can buy this one-time $6 registration and go as much as you want with that. Section 7 has the same language for ATVs. All-terrain vehicles may be issued. It doesn't say shall. So again, it's voluntary if they're 25 years or older. And Section 8, carrying over to the top of page 5, has that one-time registration for the ATV of $6. Section 9 also deals with our all-terrain vehicle safety training programs. Currently, all of our safety training programs have the ability to charge up to the registration amount required by the DNR. This class did not have that. Some instructors were charging more than what the actual cost was for the course. DNR charges $15 per student for materials and things like that. We're just clarifying here on 5.25 and 5.26 that the instructor may charge an additional fee up to that amount. It's the same with all of our other safety training programs that are out there, supported by the training members, our volunteers. Section 10 clarifies that grant and aid trails for ATVs may be in road ditches if permitted by the road authority. What we're trying to do, if the road authority approves of this, it would be to allow a grant and aid trail to operate within, you'll see on 6.2, it would allow for the operation of an ATV on the shoulder, inside bank or slope, ditch or outside bank or slope of an interstate, of a trunk, interstate, county, state aid, or highway when the new language that we're including, this is part of a funded grant and aid trail. So it would be the road authority would still have the ability to deny this. The DNR would still have the ability to deny this. We have a 7-step process in actually citing and permitting a grant and aid trail. It includes review by our ecological resources folks, our fish and wildlife divisions. There's also checks with the local units of government, the club, and the road authority. So if everybody approves of this and it's the right place to put them, we're just saying that it's eligible to be there now. Section 10 or Section 11, this is an issue. Section 11 and 12, we discussed this last year and actually passed the House. We got caught up in conference committee clarifying the segments of the Arrowhead Regional Trail and the Willard-Munger Trail system. Confusion exists right now on the motorized portion of actually it's the Minnesota-Wisconsin Boundary Trail that is currently established as a segment within the Willard-Munger Trail system. You'll see on 8.16, it says the one segment shall be known as the Boundary Trail, originate Chisago County and extend into Duluth. This is actually a dirt trail, ATV trail in the summertime, snowmobile trail in the wintertime that feeds into the North Shore Trail and into the Arrowhead Trail. So we're moving that out of the Willard-Munger, and you can see on 8.1, including that segment into the Arrowhead Regional Trail System. Section, 13 talks about the deposition of fees. Currently, when we have a natural resource, when we sell natural resource items, timber, biomass, whatever it might be within a state park, those funds are deposited within the general fund. We're clarifying that when we do have a sale of a natural resource item, if there's a blowdown, for example, that brought us to our attention, blowdown within the St. Croix State Forest, the salvage price of that timber, those revenues were deposited into the general fund. We had to go then find other sources of revenue, do the restoration work and those other activities. So we're clarifying that when those types of activities occur, those deposits can be put into State Parks working capital account for us to do those natural resource activities. Section 14, just as a clarification of that statute, saying that when we do that resale or rental in the state parks, that the purchases for resale or rental within the state parks capital account are exempt from competitive bidding. It's just clarification dealing with that the natural resource pieces, because there's no competitive bidding that goes on those activities. Section 15 is kind of bringing our terminology up to speed as we talk about we have hiking and biking and snowmobile and ATV trails, but then when it goes to canoe and boating, we have canoe and boating routes. We want to call the canoe and boating routes actually water trails, and we're changing the name from canoe and boating to water trails, and we're actually adding a segment in the Blue Earth River, just to clarify that the Blue Earth Rivers are part of our water trails as well. This will just help with our promotion as we're out talking about our trail system. It's water, it's land, it's hiking, it's biking. It's not the canoe and boater routes are sometimes confusing to people. Section 16 is some language we're actually in the process of working on with Representative Saylor that we'll be talking about in the future. But what we were trying to clarify here is that you'll see it's kind of a recodification of the language for the grant and aids. Instead of sponsored by local units of government, we were saying two counties and municipalities for construction and maintenance of cross-country ski trails, special park districts, and development and maintenance of state cross-country ski trails. Right now, the state system for cross-country ski trails is the only trail system that does not receive any revenue from the permits, but we're working with some language that would allow the legislature to be able to appropriate those dollars if there's money available in the accounts in the future. So I believe we'll be working on that as this bill travels to the Finance Committee. Section 17 changes the horse trail pass to actually a horse pass. What we're seeing, and when we discuss this with the Horse Council and they support this, is some people, rather than acquiring a horse trail pass, will be riding off of the trail, next to the trail, off trail in the state forest. It's legal to drive, to ride off trail, but we don't want to make it an incentive for somebody not to buy a trail pass, if to ride off trail or adjacent to the trail. So we're changing it to just the pass will be required on all lands administered by the commissioner. So there's you can see where we're striking the language on 10.11 and 10.12, where previously it was on horse trails and associated day use areas on state trails, in state parks and state recreation areas, and in state forests. We're changing that term to lands administered by the commissioner, and just striking trail and making it a horse pass. So you can see that through those two sections. And the last one there is subdivision 711.26, changing that horse trail pass language to a horse pass. Section 18, we talked about master planning requirements when we were talking about Lake Vermilion. The master plan is required before any activity, anything can be constructed in a unit of the Outdoor Recreation Act. However, there's pieces of the Outdoor Recreation Act that we do not do any construction of facilities on, and scientific and natural areas is one of those. So this section, actually, if you turn it to page 12, 12.3 to 12.4, we're adding in scientific and natural areas do not need to have a master plan. They don't need a master plan approval. Currently, wildlife management areas, aquatic management areas, rest areas, or border waysides don't need a master plan. It just makes sense we don't need that, or we don't have to do that for a scientific and natural area. Section 19, it's actually helpful if you look at the repealers in the back of the bill. Page 1R has 97B.665, impairment to drainage by beaver dams. Currently, when a drainage water course is impaired by a beaver dam, the commissioner shall take action to remove the impairment if The county board unanimously consents, the landowner approves, the commissioner agrees, and the action is financially feasible. Well, if my neighbor has a beaver pond on their property and they want to keep it there, but it's flooding my property, there's a problem there with achieving all those loops, or going through all those hoops. So what we're recommending is amending that. Actually, we're repealing that subdivision and instead making it that the action goes right to district court. If the beaver dam causes a threat to personal safety or serious threat to damaged property, a person may petition to district court for relief, and then the court may order the owners of the private property where beaver dams are located to take action and remove that dam. So right now, it would allow myself to go to take my landowner, petition to district court to have them remove, put in a Clemson beaver dam leveler, or take some action to allow that water to not impede my property or hurt my property value.
So, Mr. Meyer, you're just taking the DNR out of the equation here? Out of the equation? So they
part of it does that. Part of it also streamlines it. So if there is damage being caused to your property by someone else, you have a venue where you can occur that at, and there's not a process that everybody has to agree to have that happen.
So you're taking a nine iron to the beaver dams here? Okay.
Mr. Chair, we're trying to solve the problem where the problems may exist. Section 2021.
Sorry, Mr. Meyer, Representative Dunkey has a question.
Before you hum by that one, I guess my question is not, you know, you're talking about the burdensomeness of the deleted language, but I think the bigger question out in our area and around the state will be who pays for it. And right now you're moving the payment from the state to the landowner. And again, beaver dams, I believe, are built. There's got to be water, public water coming through. That's where the dam's built. And so now, because I live on a river or a stream that's a public water, and a public animal builds a dam, now I have to, because my neighbor says, well, I don't like what you're doing up there, now I have the expense of doing it instead of you, the department. I'm not sure that that's equitable. Again, it's a management of public waters. You keep saying it's on private property, but I can probably canoe down that stream. I can... You can do a lot of other things on public water streams. And so now you're asking a private person, a farmer in many cases in my area, to take care of a public water issue for the first time. Don't you have a sense that that might cause some phone calls to come into legislators' offices?
Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, it does shift that responsibility of burden, but a lot of these dams they may not be on a public water body as well, so we may not have that authority.
But Mr. Chair, it doesn't say that.
Representative,
again, a dam's got to be on water, and there's no differentiation whether it's a county ditch. If it's a county ditch, then it should probably be the county that pays for it. You know, if it's somehow, I don't know how it would be, I mean, to have a stream or a river all within your property that's yours, that happens certainly with smaller lakes, but not, and you know, that might have little, you know, tributaries in and out, but I mean, there's some fairly major, large beaver dams that get constructed on public waters or other county-owned waters or ditches that now you're going to make the landowner blow them things and pay for it and everything else, when really I don't think it's their responsibility.
Okay, and
Mr. Chair, or Mr. Representative, you can.
Mr. Chair and Representative Junkie, I think you bring up a legitimate concern, and I mean, even waters that are wholly within the property of an individual, they're still public waters. So I think we would remove that, and Mr. Meyer has indicated that he'd be willing to remove that provision.
Mr. Chair, I'd move to remove Section 19 and the corresponding repealer at the end, 97B.665.
Are we caving to the beaver dam lobby? Representative Junkie moves an oral amendment to... Oops, I just lost it. Oh, here we go. Representative Junkie moves an oral amendment to remove Section 19 and also on...
Page 1R, the repealer 97B.665.
And on page 20, the repealer, section 37, to delete after 2008. How's this? No, excuse me. After 2008, delete sections 97B.665, subdivision 1.
That whole section.
Right. So we're going to, yeah. So we keep in the old section. Does everybody understand the oral amendment? So we're going to keep the old language that the repealer would have taken out and get rid of that section. Any questions on the amendment? Anybody wish to testify for or against the amendment? All right. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. The amendment's adopted.
Mr. Chair, moving forward, I've brought up Kent Lockesmo with me. The next several sections deal with some recodification of water statutes and some issues with wild and scenic, so I'm going to have Mr. Lockesmo run through those.
Greetings, Mr. Lockesmo.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Kent Lockesmo, Division of Waters. Section 20, and then also as we go forward, 24, 29, and 30, are all technical changes because 103G295 is repealed and that's replaced with a new section in this bill. Section 103G287 replaces that. So Section 20 is just changing that citation. Section 21 deals with the Wild and Scenic River Program and dealing with boundary amendments. Right now, to make a boundary amendment, even any size of boundary change, we would have to go through a formal rule process. Recently, you've heard bills here in 2004, 2005, I believe there were boundary changes passed by the legislature on the Mississippi River, and those were changes that we had agreed to in the rule development process, and the rule process was taking longer than local government wished to move forward on what they wanted to see for changes in the river district, so they brought those changes here and they actually were approved. So what this is, this provides an alternative to either of those processes and allows the commissioner, after review and notice and opportunity for hearing, to do this by commissioner's order.
Mr. Lockesmo, if you can hold on. Representative Hansen and then Wagenius have the questions. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lockesmo, on the boundary adjustments, this is I look at the 13.4, talks about acreage limitations. I think that's 320 acres, but I could see a scenario here where you nibble and nibble away and it's the boundary adjustments are always cutting. Or is this intended that it would also be adding or changing or... maybe you could clarify a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, this would allow for boundary changes either direction to remove areas or add areas, although you wouldn't be able to add areas to go beyond the statutory acreage limit that currently exists, the 320 acres per mile.
Representative Wagenius.
The problem I see with this section is that there's no standard here that the commissioner has to uphold one way or the other. And if there's no standard, then this isn't streamlining. This is taking something straight to court. And the court will say, well, there was no standard. The decision was arbitrary and capricious. So it seems to me that maybe you might be going off in the right direction, but not to have a standard is I think a major flaw in what you're doing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, you bring up a good point, and we can look at developing a standard as we go forward, because certainly courts would look at whether or not there's a standard.
Very good. If you'd proceed, Mr. Meyer, Mr. Lockesmo.
Moving on, Mr. Chairman, Section 22. In our statewide shoreland rules, currently allow for flexibility as we look at ordinances, and this allows unique circumstances to be considered. So what this change does by adding the word substantially compliant, or substantially and then substantially compliant, allows that same standard to be applied for wild and scenic rivers as we look at revisions of management plans in the future. Section 23 just removes the requirement for the department to provide both maps and lists to local government. These are now provided electronically to local governments, and having the list requirement is redundant and requires more cost and expense that isn't needed. Section 24 is a change because 103G295 is repealed. Section 25 provides a clarification that the department has authority to require monitoring and reporting. And we clearly have that for individual property owners. When they're doing appropriation of water, we want to make sure we know the impacts of that and we require monitoring. What this does is clarifies that if there's an area of concern, we can look at that and apportion the costs among multiple users. An example of that was in the Mankato area, where there was a group of six entities that came together to jointly develop and fund the necessary monitoring that we needed for that system.
Excuse me just a moment. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lacasmo, I want to go back to line 14.3 and some of the old law here, and just checking to see if the classification of wetlands and habitats, if there's a more current addition, or are you still relying on the 30-year-old addition of definitions?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, this is the definition under which the original public waters inventory was completed. So that's why that is still referenced here. And it is still utilized, although there are newer classifications in existence.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I am looking back on the 14.32 and understanding why you wouldn't want to modify or restrict an appropriation, water appropriation, but the standard on 15.2 is seems out of sync with our current understanding of groundwater, and perhaps the thing that should be amended in here would be our current groundwater sustainability definition. This endangers a domestic water supply is endangers it in the short term, in the long term. It's so mushy. It feels old and not. I hope you will revisit that before you come to finance.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, we can look at that closer, and you are right that that is, it's an old section of law that was written to protect agricultural irrigation, and current standard is if there's an agricultural irrigation that's impacting a domestic water supply, an individual's well, there's a well interference process, and we deal with those. But we will look at that closer before we get to finance.
Okay, go right ahead.
In Mr. Chairman, section 25, this is the new section that replaces the deleted section 103G295. 103G295 is a section that dealt with agricultural irrigation only, and it had categories of a Class A land or Class B land. That's really an old artifact, and it wasn't the Class A and Class A areas haven't been identified across the state, so it wasn't being used. This section now applies to all types of water use, not just irrigation, so it expands the scope, and it puts it all in one place, so it's clear on what the requirements are for applying for a permit.
So we've saved a few pages of statute too if we pass this too, right?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay.
Section 26 is just a technical change correcting that citation. Section 27 is, again, this is a section that replaces the 103G295 area. And so people are clear, the threshold for requiring a permit is 10,000 gallons a day or 1 million gallons a year. So if you're under that, people aren't applying for a permit. This is the requirements for applying for permits.
And Representative Wagenius.
Just cause. I mean, that's, again, a lack of a standard, and I think you get into trouble without having more specific standards. So just review that. I don't have the language now, but that's what you're doing.
Mr. Lockhart. Chairman, we will look at that question throughout this document. Moving on, Section 28, we're deleting on line 1714 to 1716 a requirement that the applicant would have to provide a proof of service that the local government was served with their permit application. The process that we use now is the department electronically transmits permit applications to the required reviewers, the city, the Soil and Water Conservation District, and others. So this is not needed. We know that local government got a copy because we're emailing it to them, as long as email works. Moving on, Section 29, again, is a correction because of the repealed Section 295. Section 30 is also that repealed Section 295. Section 31, the stricken language on lines 1814 and 1815 were difficult to administer because we were looking at how we would determine the local government entity. Or either private or local government, recovering any of those costs would be of no avail. There wasn't a means test or anything like that, and we did have entities coming and saying it's of no avail because we said no, we wouldn't pay, and we weren't buying those arguments. So what this does is clarifies that when removal of a dam is a lowest cost option, this would allow the agency to pay the 100% of the costs, and those costs are. The funding for this comes through the bonding program, and it's also addressed in language with those appropriations. And the reason, I mean, we look at removal of river dams because they're ecologically better if you can provide fish movement. You remove hazards if you remove the drowning machine. So often it is a best solution, and most often the cheapest solution to remove instead of repair these low-head river dams. Moving on, Section 32. If some of you would recall, session laws in 2001, the first special session, Chapter 2, Section 159, passed a permanent moratorium on removing sunken logs, but the statute was never removed, and you'll see a repealer at the end that removes the statute. And this is just a section that says removing sunken logs is prohibited. So it clarifies that, and actually I had a phone call today, I had a voice message, somebody asking about information on removing sunken logs.
Very good. Representative McNamara has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lockishmo, why don't we allow the removal of sunken logs at all?
I had the same question, Mr. Lockishmo.
Mr. Chairman, this was proposed initially in the late 90s. It was... and these are on state-owned lake beds, so there's at least required to do that. There was lots of controversy, lots of environmental impacts for going and removing the substrata in a lake. And you know, essentially, I think that was it. And the and then the subsequent legislative action put a permanent moratorium on that activity because of environmental impacts.
Representative McMahon.
Well, I did review the existing language that's in statute, and it looked like there was a number of protections. Were there cases of successful removal where it seemed to make sense? My understanding, some of these are great big, huge native white pine that are laying on the bottom, and being kind of a treasure hunt kind of person, I'm trying to understand why we wouldn't want to at least allow it. I mean, is it never feasible? Is it always bad environmentally?
Mr. Lacusmo.
Mr. Chairman and Representative McNamara, you know, this program and the lease program is run through the Division of Lands and Minerals. It's we haven't been directly involved, and you're right that there were lots of large white pine and some of that resource there. But my understanding is that the environmental impacts and the associated, and that was the reason for the concern and the ultimate moratorium being passed.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, from what I know of it, the people that are out collecting the logs a lot of times are more interested in the money than they are the resource of the habitat. And when pulling these logs out really stirs up the bottom and creates a lot of problem. They can not only pull them up, but then they drag them clear over to shore, leaving a trail of mud and slime all the way and disturbing the bottom. And I would imagine that in some times they could be good fish structure if they're left there. So it's a monetary gain for the person jerking them out because some of them are quite valuable, and that's, I think, problem, whereas too much of it was going on.
Representative Junkie.
This doesn't prohibit someone from cleaning up a entry area to their property. I'd say I buy a property, there's sunken logs, I'm trying to put a boat landing or a lift in, and I got to remove a 3, 4, 5 of those things that are at propeller depth now as we come into shore. How do I manage that on my property?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie, removal of debris is allowed.
What if it's a log?
If you have one log, if you're going to go in there,
I'm going to remove it. Let's just face it. People are going to remove it. You've just said it's prohibited. So when they remove it, what happens to them now?
Actually, for Mr. Lexmite, the it's already prohibited now, right? I mean, we're just act to repeal or actually gets rid of stuff that didn't get taken out. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, yes, but to address Representative Junkie's concern, you could delete the first sentence and just leave the commissioner must not issue leases to remove sunken logs or issue permits for the removal of sunken logs. Might clarify that issue because debris removal is allowed. If somebody was going to be in there with a backhoe, they would need a permit, a public waters permit, and we would issue those for access.
I think that
helps,
Mr. Chair. If he's comfortable with that, I'd move to remove that first 1818, the first sentence. And again, I just I think it makes it clear that if I buy a lakeshore and there's two or three tipped over trees that have been there for 50 years and I'm now cleaning up to put in my bow lift or things, I'm not doing something that's prohibited, but I can pull those out and take care of my own property or the public water adjoining it there.
Mr. Chairman, we're okay with that change. If it's a tipped over tree that fell, it probably wouldn't meet our definition of sunken log, but removing that first sentence would be fine.
And what I'm looking at from your background thing is that you already have a permanent moratorium from 2001, but you didn't have the prohibition on the removing sunken logs, so we're getting rid of that. Okay. So Representative Junkie moves an oral amendment on page 18, line 18, removing the sentences or sentence removing sunken logs from public waters is prohibited. Is that?
Yep.
Is everybody clear? Mm-hmm. We don't want to leave any of those for the beavers, now, do we? Okay. Any questions of the amendment? Anybody like to testify? Okay. You never know. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Or opposed, nay. Okay. The oral amendment's adopted. And Representative Saylor has a question. I hope you didn't want to speak to the logs or anything, did you?
Mr. Chair, I did, but it's okay. We're kind of moved beyond that. So.
All right.
Mr. Chair, members, Section 34 and 35 relate to the non-game wildlife checkoff. You can see the first change in 1831 is just clarifying. The non-game program is actually within the Ecological Resources Division where these references are in statute. It usually refers to the Department of Natural Resources, so we're clarifying that.
In case anyone was in 30 and 34, one of the author's amendments sort of reinstates some of the stricken language.
Next page here, what we did in the author's amendment, we reinserted the stricken language on 19.4 through the period on 19.7. So the Commissioner of Natural Resources will still continue to submit a work program for each fiscal year and some annual progress reports for the LCCMR. However, we'll be able to expend the money The problem that we had was none of the monies could be expended until the work plan was approved, and the money is appropriated directly through the legislative process. So we're clarifying that. 19.14 to 19.21 allows, it states that the commissioner may use funds appropriated for the non-game program for the purposes of developing, preserving, and restoring and maintaining wintering habitat for neotropical migrant birds in Latin America. These are birds such as flycatchers, vireos, swallows, thrushes, warblers, tanagers, grosbeaks, orioles. They all live, they like to winter down in the southern latitudes. About 450 species to migrate down there from North America every year. This, we do a similar thing with Ducks Unlimited, or Delta Waterfowl with duck stamp dollars. We provide funding to Delta Waterfowl in Canada to protect habitat, restore habitat for nesting and migrating waterfowl. So we want to be able to do this. Many other states are doing this as well.
Does it mean we're going to have to provide habitat for all the snowbirds in Arizona because they come back here?
They already have habitat.
Okay, all right. I want to mention
pythons. Section 34 is just dealing with the corporate non-game wildlife checkoff. It has the same changes we made in the previous section with the section of wildlife and the author's amendment on the language from lines 20.1 through 20.4. Section 35. This language that we discussed previously, it's the acquisition of Lake Vermilion State Park. Section 36 is a revisor's instruction.
It's just a little
Mr.
item.
Mr. Chair, they're shameless. I'll give them that. It's in every bill that comes through here. It's unbelievable. But I'm not, Dill's gone, so it's no fun anymore.
Mr. Chair, it's not in the Game of Fish bill.
Yet.
Section 36, Mr. Chairman, is just the revised instructions for the horse trail pass or the horse pass and the canoe and boating routes. And Section 37, I believe we've deleted that first repealer, and the other two repealers deal with the water provisions that we spoke of.
Very good. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to go back to a couple of sections that I made notes about as you went past. One of them is Section 17, again, the horse pass. Has there been a significant problem, with people riding roughshod through the woods? Is there a problem with it, or has it been identified that way, and have you talked with the stakeholders involved?
Mr. Chair, yeah, the problem that we're seeing, it's the off trails that are being created that become, once the trail goes through, it becomes another trail, and we have talked to the Horse Council that they do support this change. So controlling that access is something we're looking to try to do.
Mr. Chair and Representative Saylor, evidently some people have been riding alongside the trails to avoid having to pay, and that's been creating new trails alongside them.
Thank you. Seems to have a parallel with some other trail use. But at any rate, my second question was regarding Section 28, and that's with the there was a comment, about assuming that the email works. And I know that we made that, and that was sort of a flip comment, but I do want to make sure that that actually they do, the local units of government do actually get the application that's served to them, because as we all know, sometimes things don't work, and with especially in some smaller cities and other places. Is there something return receipt requested or some way that you know that they actually did get it? Because there are a number of times when things supposedly are sent and who knows where they went.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Saylor, I will look into that, and we will look at amending this language accordingly before its next stop to deal with that if we need to.
Representative Saylor, did you have any other items? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Meyer, Section 12, the Willard-Munger Trail System, is this the section that we spent a lot of time debating last year? The sequel?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, it is the same language that we discussed last year and actually was passed off the House floor.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
But it did not become law. Is that correct?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, we got hung up in conference committee with the Senate.
Mr. Meyer, I had a question in all seriousness. In Section 33 about using non-game wildlife funds elsewhere outside the borders of the U.S., and maybe Representative Hansen could give us some insight too. I'm just thinking of how we would actually audit that. I'd hate to see a newspaper article that says no DNR money from Minnesota nowhere to be found in Costa Rica or something like that. I mean, I'm totally serious. We want to maintain the integrity of the funds and make sure they're used for what they're supposed to be used. I used to work in international development stuff years ago, so knowing how your host is using the funds is really critical.
Mr. Meyer. Chair, this would be done through a contractual agreement with an agency that is reputable doing this. One of the ones that is out there is called Southern Wings, and it's an organization. It's an international migratory bird agency similar to what Delta Waterfowl or Ducks Unlimited is. And actually, there's other states that are participating with this organization: New Jersey Division of Fish and Wildlife, Tennessee Wildlife Resource Agency, Missouri Department of Conservation, New Mexico Game and Fish. So it's not unprecedented. It's a reputable organization. It would be done with a contractual outcome. Or there would be a lot of auditable paperwork associated with this.
Okay, Representative Cornish. You weren't going to offer to be the auditor.
No, Mr. Something. Chair, I just wondered how much money we're talking about that could be expended, and then this is what drove Bob Lassard nuts, this non-game spending here for many years. I just wonder how much money we're talking about for non-game program going out to this, just round estimate.
Could Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish.
Meyer.
We haven't determined what the actual amount would be. This would be something that we would discuss with the LCCMR as we're presenting that work plan to them, which would contain a budget for the following year as well, and have some input as to what that level should be. It's not going to be millions of dollars by any means, but something that would make a benefit and have some impact for our wildlife population.
One more follow-up.
Representative Cornish.
You have any idea what the total budget for the non-game count is now about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, I want to say about $3 million, I think. I'm getting that number for you right now. So.
No problem. Thank you.
Representative McNair.
Well, to that point, and this is all money that people paid out of their own pocket as a deduction. This is a checkoff on their tax return. That's not any state money. This is deductible for them to pay on their own. It's that checkoff that
Chickadee.
Thank you. But to clarify, this is not state money.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNair, correct.
Also, having worked for nonprofits for a long time, I know that giving donors the information about where their dollars is going is really helpful. So I hope, as you move forward with that you'll publicize it in all your literature and whatnot. Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and maybe there could be some language that would be attached. I know we've referenced the grant process or the we had the whole audit a couple years ago on grants to nonprofits, and I think there's some statutory language on that provides comfort on that granting process. Maybe if there's a successor entity or things, so there's a paper trail, and I'd be willing to work with you on maybe finding that reference that could provide some standardization for protection for these dollars.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Meyer.
Representative Hansen, we will work with you on that. And again, these grants would be done in strict accordance with the grant guidelines that the Department of Administration has as well. So.
Very good. We're just trying to make sure your name doesn't get in the paper, Mr. Meyer. So. For the wrong reason. Other questions on the bill? Representative Sterner.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Just was wondering, as Representative Scalzi has a bill working on protecting the St. Croix and bringing back the stamps in the bill, is any of that language in here or any protection on the St. Croix area, either like Section 22 or Section 23?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sterner, no, it's not. We're working actually with those local units of government and trying to help them get up to speed at what the requirements are, and actually evaluating the need to revamp that language as we speak. And we think the recent court decision will help us develop the capacity for local units of government to make the right decisions, and we're looking at trying to work with them as closely as possible to make sure those decisions are done right the first time.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Vigilant staff tells me that since we took out the Beaver Dam stuff or the court stuff, we don't need to go to civil justice anymore.
That would be correct. And, so we'd be looking at sending it to government operations, I believe.
You.
Would that be correct?
Whatever it's your. Sorry? You don't want to send it to
it
finance?
It chapter 14, which would.
If you really want to go to government operations, that's true.
Okay, well, it does need to go to finance, so why don't we go to finance first?
Very good.
That's true, too.
Mr. Chair, the only provision that I'm concerned about is that in section 21, page 12, actually it's carried over in 1213, where it says, the commissioner's order is effective 30 days after issuing the order. Before the effective date, a local unit of government with jurisdiction in the affected area may contest the order under Chapter 14.
I'm sorry, what section are you looking at here?
It's section 21, the bottom of page 12, top of page 13.
I was looking for that page 13.
And we'll work on that as well.
Well, okay, so we'll go to government operations then.
Very good. Well, we'll do that. So we're going to have a couple extra floor sessions to process stuff. So
I guess I have to move.
Would you like to amend your motion and then make it as amended and so on and so forth?
I don't want to see it.
Sure. So I will make the motion to amend my motion to send it to government operations.
Very good. Representative Eakin amends his motion that the bill be sent to the Committee on State Government Operations. I don't have the whole list here, but I think we know what we're talking about here. Therefore, would you like to renew your motion as amended, and we'll vote?
Yes.
Our Representative Eakin renews his motion that House File 3092, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State Government Operations and Elections. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. The motion's adopted. The bill is passed. Yeah, Representative Dill, before the chair comes back, will Representative Dill move the adoption of the Game, Fish, and Forestry Division report for House File 3162?
I do.
Very good. Representative Dill moves the adoption of the Game, Fish, and Forestry Division reports for House File 3162 and just vote on it. All those in favor of the adoption of the report, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. Motion passes. The report is adopted. Let's see. I guess I'll. Sorry, I've been sitting here a little too long. Let me just get you started here. Representative Dill, do you want to move your bill?
Yes, I'd like to move House File 3162 be recommended to pass in the General Register.
Very good. Representative Dill moves 3162 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. Representative Dill, to your bill. You don't have any amendments?
I have just a very minor oral amendment, line 1.13. Change the 20 to 23 foot.
Excuse me, I may have the wrong. Oh, 1.13. I got it. 23. Representative Dill moves an oral amendment. Can we just do that, incorporate that? Or let's just adopt it. On line 1.13, delete the number 20 and replace with 23. Does everybody understand the amendment? Very good. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment's adopted. Okay, Representative Dill, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, to 3162 is amended. It's a resolution to Congress. The bill was reviewed in Game, Fish, and Forestry, the committee that I chair, at length. All testimony on the bill was in favor of the bill. it is a recommendation to Congress that they develop laws in concert with the state of Minnesota to properly regulate unregulated, uninspected passenger vessels that are commonly being used across the state for fishing guides. I know of at this point of no one who objects to this or the idea that this should be done. So, and there certainly was no testimony against this. So with that, I'm prepared to accept your verdict.
Any questions before we make our verdict?
Well, I'll renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and seeing no questions at all, Representative Dill renews his motion that House File 3162 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed. And the meeting is adjourned.